venerated about this bourgeois atheism. There's also bourgeois republicanism, because Italy's a republic, France's a republic, US is a republic. It doesn't change the fundamentals of the situation. And we also have to remember that although these countries have republics, the head of state has powers. Of course, the head of state sometimes is directly elected by the people, like in, well, not indirectly in the American system, but elected. In Italy, he's elected by the combined houses of parliament and other institutions of elected people. So there's an element of democracy there. But the president has similar powers to the Queen, in the sense that he's the one who nominates the Prime Minister, he's the one that the government resigns to, he's the one who dissolves Parliament. And you'll notice that even in republics, although they don't have a House of Lords, they have a Senate. And what is the Senate? The Senate is a second house which is there to put a break on the first. In Italy, for example, you have to be 25 to vote for the Senate. Whereas, that's what it was until recently at least, whereas you can vote for Parliament at 18. The idea being that amongst the younger ones, there's a more radical vote, and that's usually the case when the class struggle is on the up, and amongst the older layers, there's a tendency for a more moderate stance. Plus, there's a number of senators who get nominated for life. For instance, Andreotti is a life senator, and Agnelli, the boss of Fiat, was a life senator. So there's less democracy in the second house than in the first, and its role is to check, and all the bills go from the first to the second chamber. The second chamber can put a break, can amend, like the House of Lords. So we shouldn't have this idealistic view of republicanism as somehow solving the problems of changing society. It does appear there's a lot of sort of bourgeois liberals who are indignant about monarchy, but they're not indignant about concentration of capital in the hands of a few rich people, and they're not indignant about unemployment. They just think this is a remnant from the past. And the bourgeoisie in some countries has, you know, like the French Revolution, they cut the king's head off, but they didn't produce an egalitarian society. So they have similar powers. In some countries, more powers, like the French and the American, the president has more powers than, say, the Italian or the Greek. But the head of state is still there, and he gives the annual speech at Christmas or New Year or whenever it is, talks to the nation, and he's usually it's a man, sometimes it's going to be a woman, but usually a father figure, old man, wise, usually a foreign politician who's made a career out of it and now distances himself from the past and pretends to stand above all parties. Same kind of thing. So the fundamentals don't change on that. The thing is that what they try and say is that the Queen has no such powers, whereas she has. When I said the 1930s, I meant a critical moment in the class struggle, where if Britain had faced a similar crisis as Germany or Italy or Spain, the monarchy would have had to play more of a role. It would have had to bring into play its powers. It never had to, because the crisis in Britain never reached the same degree. The bourgeoisie never had to go down the road of the coup, although they thought about it. And in the 70s, they did consider it, and they were plotting against Wilson, but again, didn't need to do that, and therefore didn't need to expose the real powers of the monarchy. The question of universal suffrage is when every universal suffrage first was for men. All men finally got the vote. Before, only people with property could vote. So only a small minority of the population could vote. And when only people with property, especially when the overwhelming majority had no property, men with property, yes, you're pretty safe. They would vote the Whigs, the Tories, the Liberals, and the Tories, basically. And all of them accepted the class structure of society and property and all the rest of it. Once you give the vote to all men, to begin with, that means working men, unemployed men, poor men can also vote. And then when all women had the vote as well, it meant the whole population could express their views. The monarchy became more important, as Bejshak points out, with this aura, this kind of magic about it, to capture the imagination of millions of people, that this is somehow a father figure that stands above society. If you remember, the Tsar, when the people moved the first time in 1905, they went to petition the Tsar, because they thought he would listen, because the government's not listening. The king, surely, the king, he's the king of all the people, he will listen. And they went to petition him. Poor people, dreadfully miserable poor people, marching to petition the king. Of course, the king answered by shooting them. They opened fire. And that radically changed the opinions of the masses towards the king. And that's why the Tsar ended up the way he did after the revolution. There was a burning hatred of the royal family because of what they did. But we see this throughout history, this idea that it's a figurehead who stands above, and if only we could get to him or her, as the case may be, if it's a queen, they would listen to us. And of course, as Bejshak said, it hides the real situation and allows those who really govern to get on with the business behind the backs of the monarch. The Queen of Australia, formally speaking, she owns all the land of Australia.
And Canada,
if she tried to take it, though, it would be another question. I don't think the Australians would be too happy with that. Mm-hmm. But the point is this: what happens is they have a governor, going back to the old days of the empire, and the governor of Australia embodies the powers of the monarch, and it's the governor in Australia who applies those powers in Australia. And although he symbolically represents the Queen, he's part of the Australian state structure and can decide to bring in certain powers. And they did in the 70s. Not to carry out a coup, but to call elections and change the political balance in Parliament and go for another government. Republicanism in Britain is growing. But although we're in favour of the abolition of the monarchy, it's not a demand you pose in isolation, and it's not the central and main demand of socialists in Britain, because it's not going to be posed in isolation from the class struggle. It's not going to be something which people will say, "Oh, we want a republic now." You know, there have been moments in the past where Britain has been close to that, but it's always in a revolutionary crisis that demand will assume significance and relevance. Precisely because in a revolution or a mass upsurge of the working class, then the bourgeois will have to bring out all the powers they have and all the instruments they have, and they will have to use the monarchy. And in doing that, they will destroy the authority of the monarchy in the eyes of the masses. And that's when the question of what are they doing, why are they there, will be posed by the workers. But the workers won't start off, first we get rid of the monarchy and a republic, and then we'll think of wages and hospitals. No, first the workers are going to struggle for better hospitals, better healthcare, better education, jobs, decent wages, and they're mobilising in a big way. And you saw that on March 26th. The NUJ has voted formally in favour of a 24-hour general strike coordinated with the other unions. This demand is growing within the trade union movement, and that is really the most important question. But in doing that, where will William, if he ever becomes king, or before him Charles, stand in the face of such a movement? They will try and use their powers, and it's in the process of the class rising up for its rights and trying to change society that a logical step will be that in the programme the monarchy has no role to play. The monarchy served the feudal aristocracy, and today it serves the capitalist class, so it survived in a certain sense the English Revolution as an institution, transferred its role to serving another class, the bourgeois, with lots of remnants of feudalism, of course, but it serves fundamentally the capitalist class of Britain, although it's a feudal institution. A monarch cannot recycle itself and serve a socialist republic. And there will be no need for it, because there will not. Once you abolish classes, there's no ruling class as such, dominating another class. There's no need for a monarchy either. or all these, or all the trappings of the monarchy and the bourgeois institutions that go with it. So it's important to understand the role of the monarchy, but it's also important to understand that its destiny is directly linked to the class struggle and the working class coming to power, which will put an end to it, and that's how it will come about. Just as in the United States, or in France, or in Italy, or any other republic, the class struggle and the workers coming to power, they'll have to dismantle those institutions as well, just as the monarchy is dismantled, because we won't need a president that stands above all parties, formally speaking, but actually defends the interests of one class. We'll just have a completely democratic system of representation, elected by all the working people, all the people, delegates elected, right of recall, and a worker's wage, which is a big difference from what the Queen and her family earn today. I'll leave it there.